Our next speaker, Dan Kessinger, is famous for several things, one of which are the unique biographical sketches that he submits when he does a lecture. I've never done this before to him, but I'm not getting any younger, and I want to do it now. I just want to read the first two paragraphs of his biographical sketch. Dan was unfortunately born in a place other than West Virginia. I don't know if the unfortunate part is that it was other than West Virginia or that you were born. Was it? Son of the late Bob and Doris Kessinger, he and his wife, the former Mary Amy West, have two boys. DJ is a graduate of the West Virginia School of Preaching, and Thomas is a college student. To the surprise of all concerned, Dan graduated from Walton High School in Roane County, West Virginia, and attended a High Valley College. There, the administration was faced with the hard choice of graduating him or having him stay longer. This explains his associate and bachelor's degree in biblical science. In all seriousness, Dan is a thoroughly excellent gospel preacher, very intelligent man who cares deeply about the souls of people and about the truth of the gospel. He has preached in congregations in Bell, Long Valley, Gandyville, Proctor, St. Mary's, now preaches for the Mount Alto congregation and is working his way into full-time position with the School of Preaching here, taking on many more classes. And we're very blessed to have Dan with us this hour.
I'm glad to see all of you. I actually appreciate when people have the guts to read the biographical sketches I provide. I do need to update that probably needs some new jokes because those have mostly been used. We have a serious matter on our hands today, and that's Romans chapter 4. I'm going to try to do it justice. It's a hard chapter. And as I'm thinking back, I seem to recall that I'm the knucklehead who volunteered for this. And so here I am with this. And it does supply us with some challenges. The topic is Abraham and the case for justification by faith. Now, when we think about Abraham, we're talking about somebody whose importance can scarcely be overstated, perhaps even measured. Three of the world's religions claim Abraham as their father. To the Jews, he was the original progenitor. To Christians, we are urged in this very chapter to live as children of Abraham. And to Islam, of course, they consider Ishmael to be the promised son, but they say Abraham is our father, and I suppose they're correct. And it's interesting to me that all three of these religions, their members continue to name sons Abraham with some spelling variations. Now, in the case of Islam, the story is somewhat twisted. And again, they say Ishmael was the promised son. It's interesting to me that they have that much correct, that there was such a thing as promised son, but they misidentified. But even that kind of tells you how great Abraham was. I mean, why bother hijacking a second-rate hero and making him your own? Here in Romans chapter 4, we have a discussion of justification by faith. You're going to hear circumcision discussed several times in the course of this lesson. But what we have is circumcision and the law of circumcision used as the fulcrum of a larger discussion of faith versus first century Judaism. And I want to stress that because we're going to come back to that, I think, a number of times. It is first century Judaism that much of the chapter is discussing. Now, there are some general principles, and we'll try to get to those that probably apply to the law in its true format. But I think that it's important to recognize that some of the things that Paul writes here about what was thought about the law was unique well, maybe not unique to the first century, but was uniquely incorrect. And in order to get there, let's think about the real nature of the law and see if we can see this principle emerging. Other places, Paul had said the following things about the law, and it doesn't really seem to resonate with what he's writing here. For instance, in Romans chapter 7 and verse 14, where he says, well, we know that the law is spiritual, but we are carnal, sold under sin. Or in Romans chapter 3 in verses 1 and 2, when he says, what advantage hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? And then he says, much in every way, for unto them were committed the oracles of God. And so we have here the first two verses that we have cited. We note that the law was, number one, it was spiritual. Number two, it was advantageous. Number three, in Romans chapter 7 and verse 7, we learn that the law was moral. Paul said, is the law sin? God forbid. I would not have known sin but by the law. For I had not known lust, but the law had said, thou shalt not covet. So what actually is going on here then, if he's saying these things about the law? Well, let's look at the first few verses, and let me read that to you in verses 1 through 3. We're talking about Abraham then in this first section, which is basically verses 1 through 8, and the concept of imputed righteousness. Now, in verses 1 through 3, the text reads, what shall we say then that Abraham, our father, is pertaining to the flesh, hath found? For if Abraham were justified by works, he hath whereof to glory, but not before God. For what saith the Scriptures? Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. I don't want to get ahead of the lesson that I have planned, but let me make the point. People say a number of things about these principles that we begin even here that are not correct. And so I think that we have to get straight what he's arguing against. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment, Lord willing. But first, let's see. Now, if we have this picture of the law that's presented in places like Romans 7 and 14 and Romans chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, what were they doing with the law that was incorrect? Now, first century Judaism is different than what we see revealed in the Old Testament. I think that's important to establish at the outset. There is a great difference in what God had designed the law for and what it was being used for. The true purpose of the law, as used correctly, was actually to bring men to Christ, to bring men to the new covenant. And with the conflicts that you see in the Gospels, with the rejection of the gospel, the widespread rejection of the gospel on the part of the Jews, it seems to me that they didn't recognize what the real purpose of the law was, as evidenced by that very rejection in Galatians chapter 3, verses 24 and 25. Wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us where? To bring us to Christ. We might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster. Incidentally, this is one of those cases where I believe the 400-year-old version makes a better use of wording than the more modern ones, which typically will read tutor. There's something more in the law than just being a tutor. There was also the flavor in that word of having authority over people. So it was not just to instruct, but it was also to provide discipline to those who were living under the law. So what were the Judaizing teachers doing in the first century? Well, they were elevating some of God's laws above all of the others, and I can't tell you exactly why, but we do recognize that circumcision was a very important part of that law. Now, the Jews called themselves children of Abraham, and that had two meanings. One was, we have a physical kinship, that is, we are the fleshly descendants of Abraham. And secondly, it meant that we continue to practice the seal of the covenant, which was circumcision. Those two things made them the children of Abraham. And so the law had been twisted. Maybe that's too strong a word, but at the very least it had been reimagined, maybe that's too strong a word too, by those who were practicing this in the first century. Now, what gets done with Romans chapter 4 today? Well, as we'll see a couple of times in the course of this study, it has become the unwilling bondservant of Calvinists, who throughout the chapter argue that the word law is a reference to all legal requirement. It would appear that since he's arguing against the law of circumcision, to thus generalize this into a condemnation of all law is a risky and tenuous business. But as we think first of those outside the church, the idea that they would propound based on this is, and I'm looking at verse 2, if he's justified by works, he has something to glory of, but not before God. And so Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And somebody jumps up and says, see, there it is, faith only. Or grace only, depending on what day of the week it is. And I've always been amazed that a person will tell you we're saved by grace only, and then in the next breath say we're saved by faith only, and it doesn't even seem to bother them if they have a contradiction even in their onlys. If it's by faith only, it can't be by grace only. If it's by grace only, it can't be by faith only. F.F. Bruce remarked that the theme of the Reformation was by faith alone, by grace alone. He started through faith alone. To God alone be the glory. That is a contradiction of terms. Well, now let's go back to the wording, though. What about this word law? Throughout this chapter, he's going to talk about the word law, but we have to understand the role that circumcision is playing, because that's the one that he's discussing throughout. Now, again, agreed. We're talking about principles that are a little more general than just circumcision, but that stands for a particular law. Now, somebody comes along and says, well, law can either mean, and Cecil Hook in his little book said this, he said law has a range of meanings. It can be the legal system or it can be a general principle. And he utterly ignored the real definition of law here, which is the law of Moses. How do we know that it's the law of Moses? Because that's the law that he's discussing. All right, now, what happens with this distortion of law as a definition? What does it do to our understanding of salvation by faith with regard to Abraham? Again, it convinces some people that what he's arguing here is that Abraham was saved by faith and he didn't have to do anything. Now, in order to argue that, you're going to have to change the story of Abraham quite considerably. As it applies to circumcision, Abraham received that law at a considerably later time. In fact, it was 24 years after he had received his original call to leave Ur. We might ask the question, does this indicate to us that circumcision was not an absolute requirement? Well, Abraham evidently didn't view it that way. And if you're going to argue that circumcision was optional, you might consult with Moses, because the Bible tells us in Exodus chapter 4, verses 24 through 26, and I know it's accommodative language, but what the text reads is, God tried to kill him because he hadn't circumcised his two sons. I don't know about you, but that sounds like a pretty serious matter to me. No, it isn't arguing for the things that people claim that it's arguing. So what exactly then is wrong with the Judaizing model of New Testament Christianity? Okay, most of, not all of you are aware of this. What they were doing was saying to Gentile Christians, there are at least certain things in the law that you must honor. And I couldn't tell you exactly why they settled on circumcision. That brings up a whole host of questions that I'm not prepared to answer. And the first one that our students always ask in this case is, how'd they check? And I don't have the answer to that one. The answers are all bizarre to me. But in fact, I don't even want to say anything after that. Anything I say is going to be a problem after that. I don't know. But it was awfully important to them. So what they were saying to the Gentile Christians is, you at least have to do that. And it might even be that they felt they were being magnanimous to these Gentile Christians in only requiring that. Well, what do we gain from that? There was a basic failure in principle here to understand that the lawgiver stands above the law. Now let's, again, think about what they were saying. They were saying that in order to be pleasing to God, one had to be circumcised, and we're going to get to this in a little more deeply in a moment, and what Paul is saying in response was, wait a minute, Abraham, your father, was a saved individual before circumcision ever even existed. Therefore, the implication is somebody might be pleasing to God after it ended. That is, if it is a matter of faith. Now, if your faith is in the law rather than in the lawgiver, you might have a problem. And that causes us to think of some other implications here. You see, if we don't understand that the source of our faith is in the lawgiver rather than in the law, we're going to focus on the wrong things. This should not be, again, construed as saying that circumcision was optional. It was not optional. But what it says to us is that people often focus on the wrong thing. It happened all through the Bible. They focused on the wrong thing. You remember what happened to the bronze serpent in the Old Testament, the one that Moses held up in the wilderness? Next thing you know, it became an idol. I guess they thought it was some kind of magic. You remember how they misused the ark? Remember they brought it up to the battle and ended up losing it? I don't know if they thought it was shooting laser beams out like Indiana Jones or not, but they obviously thought it was the wrong thing and were using it the wrong way. They focused on the object rather than the one who had given it. They focused on the law rather than on the lawgiver. Now, if you focus on the lawgiver, what are the implications of that? It means that if God is sovereign, and he is, he has the right to change that law, and men have the obligation, because of their love of the lawgiver and their faith in the lawgiver, to likewise change. Paul's argument here is this. His argument is that if the virtue were in the circumcision, then yes, everybody ought to continue to do it. But if the virtue is in the faith in the lawgiver, now pause, that doesn't mean you have the option to disregard the lawgiver. If that's the case, Abraham could have stayed in Ur and been blessed. But if your faith is in the lawgiver, those of you who are Jewish Christians, who believe yourselves to be children of Abraham by virtue of your birthright and this particular act of obedience, then you can't bind that on anybody, because if you really have faith in the lawgiver, you are going to agree with what he has done in this new covenant. Now, there are some final general things that we do need to recognize that maybe fall outside of the category of the distortions of the law of the first century. You find those beginning in verses 4 and 5 where he talks about the one, let me just read it. Now to him that worketh is a reward not reckoned of grace but of debt. But to him that worketh not but believeth on him that justified the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness. Once again, he's not arguing that we don't have to obey God. How do we know that? Because all through the Bible, all through the New Testament, we find people who are standing up and saying, men and brethren, what should we do? And they always got a sensible answer. I'll tell you something else. Paul was one of those men. In Acts chapter 9 and verse 6, he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And the Lord said unto him, go into the city, it will be told thee what thou must do. Paul is not condemning the Judaizers for obedience. Do you understand that? He's not saying, thou shalt not obey. That's nonsense. It's the kind of work, the kind of law that he's talking about, and we need to properly identify it and define it in each case. But the general principle that he deals with here goes a little beyond that, I think. And it goes something like this. I think the implication here is that among those first century Jewish Christians, the ones that were causing this trouble, is it possible, do you think, that they had a view even of Old Testament law that said, and when we obey, we have earned our salvation? I think that is entirely possible based on what they were doing here. Now, was that true? And you hear people saying, or at least implying, that that's the system that was in place under Moses. Well, no, that never was true. Grace was evident in the Old Testament, but that view, when it applied to the New Testament, was obviously also incorrect. And so what is the contrast to all of this? The contrast, folks, is this simple phrase, imputed righteousness. And in the model of imputed righteousness, here's how it works. We anticipate standing before God in judgment. We anticipate standing hoping for the phrase that we long to hear, that we had read in Jesus' promise, come ye blessed of my Father. What's it based on? I anticipate standing before God, not asking that I might be declared innocent on the merits of the case. And if I'm standing on the merits of the case, I'm doomed. But rather asking for mercy based on imputed righteousness. All that means we don't have to do what God said. It never meant that. But there is a world of difference between standing in imputed righteousness and standing in our own righteousness. I think that they were thinking in terms of standing in their own righteousness. And if that's what we're looking for, we're doomed to failure. It's interesting to me to think about this phrase that ends our section when he quotes from David in Psalm 31, saying, blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin. I know that David wrote this from inspiration. I know the Holy Spirit inspired him to write it, but I suspect that David had a personal stake in that statement. It's been said, sweetest words that anyone could ever hear are the words, I forgive you. And I suppose that all of us have had occasion to hear those words and to understand the relief of knowing that another human being has truly forgiven you of something for which you needed forgiven. But that's nothing compared to knowing that based on God's imputed righteousness that he says to mankind, including a man such as I forgive you. So we go into the next section, which includes verses 9 through 16. I titled it Abraham, Faith, and Circumcision, although I'm not sure that's the best description. It's the best that I could do. And how those things tie together. And again, we've already talked some about circumcision, but circumcision is so evident in this chapter, we'll probably allude to it all throughout our study today. The first thing that you notice in this section is that the justification of Abraham, while uncircumcised, has certain implications. What are they? Well, one of those is that that Abraham was justified in an uncircumcised condition, which was, quite frankly, unthinkable to the Jews. But if he were justified in uncircumcision, what that meant was he could be the father of the uncircumcised Gentile, even as God had always intended to make the Gentiles part of this system of faith, and that he was also the father to the Jews, but not because of circumcision, because of faith. It is said in verse 10, it's verse 11, that circumcision was a sign of the righteousness of faith. And that's where he says he might be the father of all them that believed, though they be not circumcised. And then verse 12, the father of the circumcision, or father to the Jews who were circumcised. So through this seal of righteousness, he is said to be the father then of both groups. The third thing you notice in this section is that the promise that was given to Abraham was not a promise that was given through the law. Now, what does that mean? Once again, we're back to this idea of what was the law? What was its intent? How was it used? How was it abused? How was it misused? How was it changed into the first century? And in the middle of all that, I think we're going back really to the real purpose of the law. What I mean is, what I believe that Paul is driving at here, this is not about the misuse of law. This was about the real law. In other words, the promise of Abraham, because it was intended to be a universal promise, because it was for all families everywhere, it was inappropriate at the very least to tie those promises to the specifics of the law. Why is that? Because the law had no provision, no ultimate provision for propitiation, as does that under Christ. He is then he was the source of the promise, but that promise was to all people. That brings us then to verse 15, which is a puzzle to some. Verse 15 is the verse, and you've probably heard it many times, because the law worketh wrath, for where there is no law, there is no transgression. We have three options to understand this. Somebody might just think it's almost a non sequitur, where it's just thrown, this is a principle that most people understand. I would say it's a postulate. Where there is no law, there is no violation. If you're being charged with a crime, there has to be an actual law. It can't be that you violated a non-existent law. Is that what he's saying? And if that's what he's saying, it doesn't have any real meaning in the context. Others are quick to jump in with this notion that this means there are no requirements, no law, we're saved by grace only. Now, if that's the case, again, it's utterly divorced from the context. And if that's the case, he's arguing some things that are absurd. Throughout the chapter, I want to reiterate, people are quick to try to apply the principles of Calvinism, and they really can't do it correctly. If you go back to verse 9, when he says Abraham was justified while he was not circumcised, you have people saying, see there, that means he was saved by faith only. Really? Is that what it means? Because what he's really arguing is he was saved before it was given as a law. And it's pretty hard to make that argument concerning baptism, which as a law was given over 2,000 years ago. So I don't think that we can correctly make that statement or make that application. And you would be better off if you could somehow prove that Abraham was saved and he never had to leave Ur in spite of God's commandment to do so. So that's not what he's saying. And in order to make this contextual, what we end up with in verse 15 is this. The Jewish Christians were attempting to have consequences put upon those who were disobedient to the law of circumcision. Now, what Paul has done throughout the chapter has shown us that that law has now been done away with. Therefore, since there is no law, there should be no consequences. Where there is no law, there is no wrath. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Now, at the end of the section, verses 15 and 16, again, we have a grand conclusion. And let me read that to you, verse 16 alone. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be of grace to the end, the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. The last phrase, I believe, kicks off the last section. But let me say before we leave this part that if we're going to really be saved by the faith of Abraham, for those who say, and that means we don't have to do anything, I suggest that you reacquaint yourself with the story of Abraham. Because there's few people anywhere in the Bible who were called to do more than Abraham. Why did he do those things? He did them because he believed. Why did he leave Ur at age 75? Why did he continue to follow God over the next 25 years until Isaac was born? He did all those things by faith. If you want to find justification for salvation by faith only, you better go anywhere else but Abraham in order to get there. Brings us to the last section. Children of Abraham. He's father of us all. It's interesting to me to think about the power of the name Abraham to these folks. You ever thought about that? I mean, if you think about it, the original three patriarchs, there were three, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And even you could have called yourself the child of any of these, and in one respect, it would have made more sense to go with Jacob. Why? Because other nations emerged from Abraham. Other nations emerged from Isaac. Jacob was the father of Israel alone. They wore his name. But it's really strange to me to think about how much the Jews focused in on Abraham. Maybe if there had been an ancient Mount Rushmore in Israel, it would have just had one face on it, and that was Abraham's. Maybe. But you remember how they would call themselves the children of Abraham. Like in Luke 3 and verse 8, John used that, said, say not we're children of Abraham, and God's able of these stones to raise up children to Abraham. It was all about Abraham. They were the children of Abraham. What's he say about being the children of Abraham? He begins in verse 17 with a reminder of the promise originally found in Genesis chapter 17 and verses 4 and 5. It was not an informal declaration. Rather, it was a formal resolution. As it is written, I have made thee the father of many nations before him who he believed, even God who quickeneth the dead and calleth those things which be not as though they were. I think that it's helpful to us to remember when this took place. It was a momentous year in the life of Abraham. It was his 99th year. He was 99, and his wife Sarah was 89. And God gave him this assurance, I have made thee the father of many nations. It was the year of Isaac's conception. It was a year that he had been told, Ishmael is not the promised son, although I'm going to bless him. It was the year when he confirmed, a year from now, Sarah will have a son. Now, there are implications of that resolution. They begin with this, and we find that within the verse, verse 17. The first implication to me is the power of him who promised, and the power of him who had revealed himself to Abraham that day. God, he said, quickeneth the dead, calleth those things which be not as though they are. If God has that kind of power, what can he do? Well, he can bring life to a dead womb. If he has that kind of power, he can bring the dead back to life. If he has that kind of power, then he has the authority to change his law when the time is right. If he has that kind of authority, he is God, he is the lawgiver. The first implication he actually spells out for us, and that is the power of God. Number two, the power of hope. The next verse is fascinating to me. Verse 18, when it reads, who against hope, New King James reads contrary to hope, believed in hope. What does that mean exactly? Who against hope believed in hope. I have an answer. I hope it's right. According to earthly evidence and experience, there was no hope. The situation was, as we would say today, hopeless. An 89-year-old woman getting pregnant by a 99-year-old man, that's absurd. I know they lived longer in those days, but they felt it was absurd. Everybody who knew them thought, it's hopeless, it's over. In the end, the only thing they had was God's testimony on the matter, which leads us to this implication that I believe is important. In our generation, we have believed it necessary to spend a great deal of time and effort proving that the Christian faith is a reasonable one. And make no mistake about it, I'm not opposed to those efforts. In my own feeble way, I try to do those myself and encourage those who are much better at it than I. But when it's all said and done, you do realize in the end, it's still a matter of faith, right? I mean, we can provide people the evidence, and the evidence is compelling and overwhelming that God exists and that Jesus is his son and that he arose from the dead. But you know what? We can provide all of the evidence and reason and logic in the world, and somebody might even be convinced that that's true and say, that's nice, and walk away. I'm thinking of what happened to Paul in Acts chapter 17. I think he provided sufficient evidence to say that God is real and that Jesus arose from the dead. And some of them mocked. Others said, we'll hear you again on this matter. And even those, I'm not convinced that he really convinced them to become Christians. In the end, it is still a matter of faith. And we're not apologizing for that. We glory in that. At some point, we have to say to ourselves, no, I have never seen anyone after he died. But I believe God. No, I wasn't there when Jesus was shown to have arisen from the dead. And yes, I believe that the evidence is overwhelming. But the bottom line is, I believe God. It's not blind faith. I'm not preaching that. But it's something a little more than just an intellectual exercise. What was Abraham hoping for? Was he just hoping for a great nation? If so, his hopes and dreams would have been dashed by the disobedience of Israel and their ultimate destruction, not only by the ancient kingdoms of the Old Testament, but eventually by Rome. Was that what he was hoping for? No, he was hoping for more than that. He was hoping, it would seem, for something that would bless all people. And he was hoping for a spiritual realm, as the Hebrews writer reminds us in Hebrews 11 and verse 10. For he looked for a city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. He was hoping for more than just what he could see. Number three, it reminds us of the nature of his faith. There were three extraordinary statements to me that are made. Beginning in verse 19. Verse 19 reads, not weak. Verse 20 reads, staggered not. Verse 21 reads, fully persuaded. And yet, when you read about Abraham, of course, in the style of God's inspiration, especially in the Old Testament, you read it with a penetrating spotlight on his life. And if somebody were to write a biography of your life, the way the Bible wrote biographies of their lives, it would have to be an unauthorized biography because none of us would sign off on that. And so we read terrible things about great people. We read about Abraham thinking along with Sarah, well, maybe Eliezer, maybe we can just adopt him and we'll help God's promise. God said no. And then Sarah used the ancient handmaid tradition, said, Abraham, get Hagar pregnant. And God said no. And two times Abram lied about who Sarah was, evidently not trusting that God would protect him from the Philistines or the Pharaoh. And you scratch your head and said, wait a minute. Looks to me like he did plenty of staggering. That's what we learn about the nature of faith. That God calls us to be faithful, and the advantage of that unflinching, unrelenting biography of Abraham is we do see all those problems, and then we come away understanding that the perfect might leave Ur and never have a second thought, and the unfaithful would stay there, and the faithful may have some doubts, but he goes anyway. And the perfect might go up on Mount Moriah whistling a tune, preparing to sacrifice his son, and the unfaithful says no, and the faithful says the Lord will provide. And the perfect says, I never have a doubt. And the faithful, or rather the unfaithful says no. And the faithful says, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. The perfect says, I never sin. And the unfaithful says, I'm not coming back. And the faithful says, I repent. Lord, help me to do better. And in the end, what Paul is talking about is not where Abraham started out, it's where he ended up. And I'm not sure how he ended up there, to be quite honest with you. Maybe he finally became convinced of God's protection. Maybe it was because of what he saw in Genesis 18 and God's extraordinary power in destroying the wickedness of the cities of the plain. And for whatever reason, God oversaw Abraham's faith. Throughout what you and I might call weakness at times, but it got it to the point where Paul could describe it as not weak, staggered not, and fully persuaded. In the end of the chapter, in just a couple of points, because we are out of time, but a couple of points that I want to make. One is, notice the importance that is given in verse 24 to the resurrection. If we're to be saved by faith, it's through the power of the resurrection, but if you look very carefully, he's actually talking about our trust in the resurrection. Now, notice the contrast between Judaism and New Testament Christianity. Judaism, likewise, was motivated by faith, but there's a great contrast here when we consider basic faith in God and the particular of the Christian religion, which is rooted in a faith in a risen Savior. The last verse, there's an interesting word, and it's the word for in the Old King James and most other versions. The New King James renders it because of. Now, it's not the word ace that many of us know and understand really can't mean because of the word that's translated for in Acts 2:38. It's the word dia. And it can mean because of, and the New King James translators made it because of, and probably get some criticism because of that, and I think they're exactly right, and here's why. Because it's used twice in the verse. Now look at verse 25, who was delivered, and I'm going to read it the way it is in that version, who was delivered because of our offenses and was raised again because of our justification. Now, if we make that because of, is that teaching Calvinism, we were already saved and Jesus died anyway? No. He's not talking about individual justification. Put it in the context. He's talking about the concept of justification. And by the way, if we don't make it because of, we've got a real problem on the first half of the verse. Do you see that? First half of the verse, who was delivered, was Jesus delivered so that we might offend? No, he was delivered because of our offenses. Well, in what sense was he raised again, because of our justification, because of God's grand scheme of redemption. God's grand scheme of redemption and justification demanded that Jesus both be delivered and be raised again.